damage that it was either at the edge of the hospital or within the hospital. The false ceiling in the operating room fell on top of us. Luckily, I wasn't injured, and I walked out of the operating room into a corridor that you could see the forecourt of the hospital in, where the families had I'd seen the families earlier on. The ambulances were on fire. Some of the cars were on fire. And the forecourt, which had been lit by that fire, was full of bodies and parts of bodies. I made my way through, and you saw some of the video there. That's a video that I took at Al Ahli, through the survivors trying to get to the other end of the hospital. I went to the emergency department. The first patient that I saw on my right was a man in his mid-50s with an amputation at the level of the mid-thigh, similar to those guillotine amputations that I was telling you about. And there was blood spurting through the exposed arteries in his stump. I took his belt and tied it as a tourniquet, and then set about trying to find someone's shirt to take it and tie it as a second tourniquet. And try to resuscitate him. Once I was satisfied that he had been stabilized, I moved on to another patient who had received a single shrapnel to his neck, and that shrapnel had hit one of the vessels in his neck and blood was spurting out of the neck. I put my hand on the wound to try to stop the bleeding and found someone else to put their hand and started resuscitating that patient. While I was resuscitating the patient, the ambulance staff started to arrive, and I had a tap on my shoulder, looked behind, and there was a stretcher with some paramedics. We moved him to the stretcher. I kept my hand on his neck so that we'd stop the bleeding and helped carry him outside. And we walked out into the forecourt to try to get to the ambulances. And that's when I saw the full extent of the carnage in the forecourt. Not only were there lots of dead bodies, but there were also parts of bodies. And I remember walking past the amputated forearm of a child. I took him to the ambulance. I then went with him to Shifa Hospital, and that's when the rest of the wounded came from Shifa, from Al Ahli to Shifa as they were brought in. And then when we had triaged and stabilized the patients and sent them up to the operating room, I went in and rejoined the burns unit at Shifa Hospital. For the following few days, I just rejoined the team at Shifa Hospital, and we were seeing more and more children, more and more burns, but we were also seeing a phenomena at Shifa, which by the time Shifa had been completely surrounded by the Israelis, there were 120 children at Shifa Hospital who were wounded children with no surviving families. Some of whom were too young for us to even know their names. These had been taken out of the rubble and there was no one left to care for them. There were over 100 major burns, and the bed crisis at Shifa had reached to the point where the wounded were being looked after on mattresses in the floors of the corridors, in the floors of the wards, in the emergency department. I stayed at Shifa for a while, for a few days, until the team at Al Ahli Hospital was able to fix two of the operating rooms and reopen the ground floor so that at least Al Ahli could be partially functioning again. Because of the pressures on Shifa, where we were less and less able to operate on patients because of lack of medication, lack of consumables, lack of anesthetic, I decided to go back to Al Ahli, but on a shuttle basis. I would take 5 or 6 patients from Shifa Hospital to Al Ahli Hospital, operate on them there, and then initially first day come back to Al-Ahli and join the team at the end of that working day and operate, and then go in the morning back to Al-Ahli and take some more cases. That continued until one morning I was in the ambulance trying to go to Shifa, because I had promised a colleague whose son had a severe facial injury that I would operate on his son at Shifa. And when we were in the ambulance, I could see at the end of the road, Israeli APCs crossing across the street that we were in. And we turned around and came back. That night, we had an influx of patients whose families managed to get them out of Shifa Hospital before it was completely surrounded. But also, we became the only functioning hospital in the whole of Gaza City. And with the exception of the Indonesian hospital, the only functioning hospital in the northern part of Gaza. We started then receiving direct injuries to Al-Ahli Hospital. And the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which manages the ambulance service in the Gaza Strip, set up a trauma stabilization field hospital inside the grounds of Al-Ahli Hospital. For that period afterwards, we started seeing more and more of these fragmentary missiles. But we also started seeing, and for the first time since I was in Gaza, people with patients with high velocity sniper injuries. And we could hear the distinctive noise that the quadcopter makes, followed by a single shot. On one day, we received 20 patients. There was a mother and child. There were some brought in dead from the quadcopters. And we discovered that these quadcopters had been released in the roads that were leading up to Al-Ahli Hospital. These wounded were trying to come to Al-Ahli to see family or for medical emergencies rather than for wound emergencies, because by that time, all of the hospitals in Gaza, including the pediatric hospitals, had been completely neutralized and put out of service. These injuries are very distinctive because the size of the inlet wound to the outlet wound is disproportionate. The inlet wound is a very small stellate-shaped wound, and the outlet wound, where that high-velocity, high-energy bullet comes out, is bigger than a clenched fist. I remained at Al-Ahli Hospital, but witnessed the dwindling of the supplies, and some of the patients, especially the little girl whose leg was covered in shrapnel that you saw, we started having to perform extremely painful procedures, including on that 9-year-old girl, without anesthetic. Patients were starting to develop wound infections, and at a minimum, we needed to clean the wounds so that we can hopefully, once things stabilize, operate on them. The final straw came when a mosque in Sabra neighborhood was targeted. 60 people had been brought in dead, and hundreds were wounded. That night, we operated into early hours of the following morning, around 5 o'clock. I was informed by my colleagues that we had run out of anesthetic and that the operating rooms would no longer be able to look after patients. That's when I made the decision to go to the south, because I had felt that as a surgeon with no access to operating rooms, no access to morphine, no access to ketamine, which is a kind of veterinary anesthetic that we used to use on patients, there was nothing for me to do. And that was day 40 of my stay in Gaza. We set out that morning, a group of us, myself, a colleague who was the anesthetist, and a couple of the nursing staff who had family in the south. And we walked for over 5 hours through what looked like a scene from a dystopian film. There were bodies everywhere. There was the sound of Israeli tanks as they were encircling and moving into position around Ahli Hospital. And there was just absolute destruction. The pinnacle of that journey comes to a bottleneck that the Israelis have created in Salah al-Din Street, which connects the north and the south, where you almost walk in a clearing or a corridor that they had made that is half the width of this room. And you, on your left, are Israeli snipers and soldiers with cameras, and you're asked to, while you're walking, to look at these cameras. And my feeling was that it's because so that the facial recognition software can find out who you are. And then the soldier would ask people to stop, and then they would say something like, "The man in the red coat, there's someone next to you, to your right, put your hand on their shoulder." And you do that, and then they say, "You, that man, leave the kid that you are carrying behind and come over here." And you could see at the very end of that left side, there were over 15 Palestinians stripped naked, blindfolded, and on their knees with their hands tied behind their backs that they had arrested and picked up from that road. I arrived at Nusayrat camp and joined another hospital in Sirat camp, but quickly realized that the crisis in consumables, in medication, in these hospitals meant that a lot of the surgeons were unable to take their patients to the operating room. And for 2 days that I was in Sirat before I left, I was just doing changes of dressing because there was no ability to operate on these kids. That's when I made the decision to leave the Gaza Strip. And the following day, my name came out on the list that at Rafah border, and I left through Rafah on day 43. Since I've left, we've discovered lots of colleagues had been killed and taken out of the rubble. Since I've left, the Israelis have bombed Al-Awda Hospital, killing 3 doctors and narrowly killing a 4th. And the whole of the northern Gaza Strip still has no hospitals functioning in it. Thank you.
What you just heard was the testimony of Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, world-renowned Palestinian British surgeon who spent over 40 days in Gaza, speaking at a press conference held in the UK on November 27, 2023. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. November 29th of each year is observed worldwide as the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. And in support of that, I will air now the remarks of Professor Tsepo Chiri, Assistant Professor of African History at the University of Houston, delivered at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at UH and organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. Let's listen in. The voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Abdel Razak Takriti, Associate Professor and Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Arab History, and the founding director of the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies at the University of Houston.
This is the situation we're living in. So as we reflect on that, we should remember that this has happened before. And we have here a very distinguished scholar of a process and a land that is very dear to every Palestinian. A struggle that we've often identified as a sister struggle, the South African struggle. There's a sense of deep comradeship in the same way that this colonial affect is manifested itself in this almost automatic solidarity and identification between different and settler populations. We have a different kind of affect going on. Those that went through settler colonization recognize each other's wounds. And that's why I'm very honored that Professor Sepulchery came with us today. It's not easy to come and speak on this topic. You'll get pressure. And she has received pressure. But you know what? She's strong as hell, and she comes from a deep and proud tradition of both knowledge and political activism. So it's a great honor to introduce you, Professor Cherry. She teaches South African history here at the University of
Amandla, go ahead to power to the people. I stand on Texas soil, but my heart is in Palestine. I stand on Texas soil, but my people in Johannesburg and Cape Town, they send their love to the Palestinian people. I send my love to those of you who have lost people. We have lost people with you. We watch, we're horrified, we're stunned. We can't believe that we are seeing the same thing again and again and again. And our hearts break. They break with the weight of seeing politics played out on children. Our hearts break because the land is stolen. Our hearts break because humanity is not recognized. Our hearts break because history is not being spoken. So I'm going to start with Baldwin. We have not stopped trembling yet. But if we had not loved each other, none of us would have survived. And now you must survive because we love you. And for the sake of your children and your children's children, you're going to survive. Start with Baldwin because that's where my heart is. I start with Baldwin because I understand that my freedom is not complete without the total liberation of all people, without the total liberation of the Palestinian people. My country got free in 1994. We lived under apartheid, which was a racial hierarchy that put Europeans on the top and then tried to divide all these people of color into these sections and these spaces. We had to live in different communities. We had to have subpar schooling. But mainly what I want to talk about today is that our land was taken away. And what I want to talk about today is that we haven't achieved liberation. And what I want to talk about today is as the world stood horrified in 1976, when the South African government shot South African children, and then it started seemingly, right, an international movement of solidarity against apartheid that took decades on decades to gain. We don't see the same thing with Palestine. We don't see that cross-international moment of solidarity. And so that's part of why I want to make it unequivocally clear that I stand with the Palestinian people, because we've got to start lining up. We've got to start saying what actually is happening. We have to actually seriously say that there is some systematic oppression taking place. As it stands, most of us are focused on the terror and the violence that we see in the Western media circuits. But we have to understand that there is another side to this, that there is a side that's underreported, that's not understood, that's underhistoricized. I'm a historian, if you can imagine that, given what I've said so far. But I won't touch the historical so deeply because I think it has been touched already. So you guys have eviscerated my notes. It's okay. But I do want to say that under apartheid, the only way that we at least politically gained freedom was because we started. Well, we had been, you know, calling out the alarm for a long time. But we were talking in rooms like this. We were distributing pamphlets, as much information as we could get out about what was happening on the ground. We tried to get out as many people that could walk around and say something on a university campus, in a community, whether it was in UK, the US, elsewhere. That's what we were doing. So what I want you to know is we have space. This is our space, right? So we leave this room and we're not going to be scattered. Hold the space. Hold the space. Like, the knowledge that we're talking about here, it's not just meant for pontification. Hold the space when you're out in the streets. Tell the story. Give the conditions on the ground. Talk about what's happening. Understand white settler colonialism and at least attempt to have people begin to understand. Unfortunately, it's a process of trying to bring people along. Right? We're trying to bring people along so that they can even begin to understand. Why don't people understand? Because they don't humanize the Palestinian people. Why don't people understand? Because we're not talking enough. We're not making enough sound, enough noise. Hold the space. Don't concede ground. So I'm not going to give myself too much time here, but I do want to read from a Palestinian mother. And I picked a mother because I'm a mother and I think about the kids. She says, "Today in Gaza, I no longer believe we'll get out of Israel's assault alive. On Wednesday, I woke up from my sporadic sleep to the sound of the bombardment that continued nonstop for the past 4 nights. Each night we wake up in a different house, but each day the sounds and the smells are we wake up to are the same. Our house was badly damaged on the first night of the bombardment. We moved to my parents' home. Then on Tuesday, a missile strike that destroyed a home just one building away left my parents' home uninhabitable. So we came to the home of my in-laws. Now there are 40 of us here. There are 40 of us here. There are 40 of us here. It feels as though the missiles are following us, getting closer with each strike, and we are running out of places to run to, which is why we hold the space. I prayed the pre-sunrise prayer and then lay down beside my two-month-old son as he slept. I couldn't smell his skin, his hair, through the stench of gunpowder, smoke, and the dust that seems to permanently fill the air. It was just minutes later and the windows blew in, covering us with shards of glass. I instinctively covered his tiny body with my own. Then I grabbed him and ran, all the while crying out for my 8-year-old daughter. My husband and I took turns hugging her when we found her. We tried to give her comfort as best we could, knowing that there was so little comfort to be found. Still shaken, we ran downstairs to the ground floor so we could leave if needed, but then the bombardment appeared to stop. Outside, the air attacks had leveled yet another home, just meters from where we were. Thankfully, the people who lived there were not inside when it struck. When we were still at my parents' home, we similarly ran downstairs and shouted cries to the neighbors, warning each other to take cover. I held my baby tightly and turned his face towards my chest as though I could shield him from the dust and the fumes from the explosives. I thought my parents' home would be safe. I thought my in-laws' place would be safe. But where do we go next? There is not a home in Gaza that is safe. Senzenina. Song says, what can we do? Can do everything. Got lights, got water. We got air. Hold the space.
Thank you, Professor Sherry, for these very, very powerful words. I know they're coming both from the heart, but also from a deep intellectual understanding. of this process. Professor Terry, by the way, is a fantastic scholar of the South African liberation struggle, and she has a book that is just appearing now. I really recommend it, Kingdom Come. It's about faith and liberation. So I highly recommend that you check it out if you want to learn about South Africa. But there's so much connections out there. And certainly the Palestinian-South African one is a very deep one. Always has been, always will be.
Professor Sepo Chiri, Assistant Professor of African History at the University of Houston, speaking at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at the University of Houston, organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames. And nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die.
I get 11, I get 11, I get 11, I get 11.
It's long and bigger. Fits long hammered naked. Fits long hammered doll's cock. Pulls it hard with so shit. Oh, yes, it's
sad.
Young, it's stirring.
Radio Lora, 97,5 MHz.